Hello, and welcome to The Optimistic American. I'm your co-host, Dr. Emily Basha. I'm here with Paul Johnson, and we have a very famous and special guest with us today, Dr. John Horrigan. He's a preeminent psychologist and professor at Georgia State University. He's recently published an excellent book. I highly recommend it, Terrorist Minds. He is an expert on the psychology of terrorism. And he is working on his new book, looking at the psychology of radicalizers.
Dr. Horgan puts a tremendous time in his books into trying to understand actually the psychology of a terrorist. In this particular episode, you're going to hear Dr. Basha talk about her experience inside of prisons working actually with terrorists, ranging from incel members to jihadists. We're also going to talk about the power of recruitment, which is the subject of Dr. Horgan's new book. We're going to talk about what's taking place on our college campuses and how this whole idea of extremism and terrorism has an ability to creep into the body politic and what we consider to be normal politics. In any event, it's a fun episode. If you're interested in hearing what we have to say, push that subscribe button and let's get on with Dr. Horgan. Dr. Horgan, Dr. Basha, and I would love to welcome you to the Optimistic American and New Frontiers today.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So we've already done in the introduction a review of the many different books that you've written on terrorism and extremism. Dr. Basha and I wrote a book called Addictive Ideologies. And as I started reading yours, there was so much even for us to learn in this. We really appreciate all the work that you put into this space. But as we get into this conversation, why don't we start with this? Because I think people oftentimes get confused when we talk about these topics. Help us define two terms. What is terrorism? And because I know that you utilize ideology as a part of defining terrorism, define for us also what ideology means.
You got it. So terrorism, first of all, is... Oh, gosh, it's one of those things that for good or for bad means different things to different people. There are lots and lots and lots of definitions out there. But the main definition, the main sort of common understanding of it is that it is the use or the threat of use of violence against civilians for some social, political, or other ideological reason. And so ideology is one of the key parts of that definition. So I'll go straight into the definition of ideology. And all I mean by that is that it is an organized set of beliefs that helps someone understand the world around them. But in the context of terrorism, it provides, often it provides justification for what people are doing. It provides direction in terms of knowing how and where to go and who your enemy is and so forth. And it also provides a sort of an urgency to act. So, you know, this idea that, well, if I don't become part of this fight now, it's going to be too late because my enemy is going to achieve their goals and my way of life will be forever at an end. So they're two very, very, very closely related things. And ideology, like I say, it's one of the key defining features of terrorism. If there's no ideological dimension present, it's not terrorism. It might look like terrorism, it might feel like terrorism, but it can't be terrorism.
Interesting. Okay. So help us take that next step, if you would. You wrote a book, I think it's called The Psychology of Terrorism. Mm-hmm. Help us understand how you actually see the psychology of a terrorist.
So over the years, I've tried to make sense of the kinds of things that motivate people to get involved. You know, we're talking about the fringe of a fringe of a fringe. There are far more people out there who hold radical or extremist ideas than will ever actually act on them, let alone act on them in terms of, you know, using extreme violence. But I try to understand the reasons that initially draw people into terrorism. In other words, what radicalizes them. And I'm also interested in the kinds of experiences people have in terrorist groups. What our research has shown is that even in the smallest of groups, and you know, terrorist groups come in various different shapes and sizes, ideologies, but even in the smallest of groups, there are lots of different roles and functions and jobs for people to do. So if the three of us are involved in terrorism, we might have very different experiences from our involvement. So when I meet with people who've been involved in terrorism, I mean, I often ask them about the kinds of things they do on a day-to-day basis, because the experiences of a terrorist bomber might be very, very different to the person who is in charge of, you know, running the social media site, for example. And then the last thing that I look at is how and why people get out of terrorism. So I'm interested in what some people have called the arc of terrorism, getting involved, being involved, and what that looks like, and then ceasing one's involvement or disengaging. So for me, I mean, you know, thinking about what a psychology of terrorism or psychology of the terrorist means, it means looking at all of that and trying to figure out if there's anything we can glean from that might somehow help us do something about it.
You know, a lot of people have focused on the front end. Very few are focused on the back end. And I definitely want to cover the back end before we're done with this. How do people get out? But let's talk about how people get in for a moment. And I'm going to start with Emily, and then she can ask the question. Dr. Basha, you spent a lot of time dealing with people who are homegrown terrorists inside of prisons, doing evaluations on them. If you can, give me your experience with different types of terrorists that you've worked with. And then if you would, maybe help us define a little bit. I know the two that you've worked with are incel and jihadism. Talk about both of those, if you will.
Yeah. So let's start with incel. That means involuntarily celibate. These are mostly white, young males who are straight. And they have a grievance against women who have rejected them sexually based on how they appear or some kind of like social defect or a mental disorder, something that's quite visible. And what's happened is that they're bought into this ideology, mostly recruited online, and that they target and victimize young, attractive women. They are bought into this ideology that causes them to see themselves as victims and oppressed by these women. And so they'll rape them, they'll kill them, they'll commit mass murders, all for this grievance. That's similar to homegrown jihadists, homegrown terrorists, in that, again, most of them are recruited online. They operate somewhat in isolation, and they could get bought in or exploited because they're feeling upset or they have this grievance, whether it's this jihadist mindset, so they see themselves be like targeting against like Western values or Jews or Israel, or it could be other Muslims that aren't practicing their faith to that same extent.
Apostates,
mm-hmm. And they become radicalized. And oftentimes what I see in the work that I do is usually their family members are shocked, whether it's this incel extremist ideology or it's the people who are facing domestic terrorism charges, very serious charges. And family members often didn't know. They saw that there was some decompensation happening with them mentally, socially. They didn't quite fit in or belong socially. There's some depression and anxiety. But then there's this starting to build up of, you know, wanting that honor, wanting to restore something that they feel has been taken. Again, they see themselves as oppressed by oppressor, and that ideology is what fuels that violent extremism.
All right, so the question I'm going to ask Dr. Horgan in a moment is this concept of your thesis, or the thesis that we used in the book, which was mainly developed by you. If you can, talk about what your belief is, our belief is, as to the evolution as to how someone gets in. And then we can have Dr. Horgan comment on whether or not he agrees with that or if he's seen something different.
Yeah, I'd love to know what he thinks. So, number one, genocides, extremism, terrorism are all fueled by ideology. Number two, those ideologies tend to separate people into the oppressed versus the oppressor categories. And number three, those ideologies that trend towards violent extremism are the ones who really objectify and dehumanize and label the other group that they see as being oppressed, who are oppressing them. So with the jihadists, you know, that's going to be, like I said before, like Westerners, infidels, Jews, Israel, apostates. For the incel members, it's going to be young, attractive females who have denied them sex.
Okay. Dr. Horgan, any comments or input, or tell us what maybe you've seen?
Sure, lots of thoughts. I mean, absolutely no disagreement, no reason to disagree with anything of what you've just said. I guess from my perspective, the kinds of things that I would dive deeply into with respect to ideology there would be, at what point in the process does someone become exposed to ideology, and at what point do they learn to engage with it? So, for example, if I'm sitting with someone and asking them, trying to find out, for example, how they became radicalized, ideology, of course, is going to crop up in the conversation. I have to be very, very careful about the ways in which I speak to people, and more importantly, I suppose, the way in which I'm listening to them. Back when I, 20 plus years ago, when I started working in this area, I would ask the same question all the time. You know, can you tell me why you became involved with this group? And 9 times out of 10, I would get an answer that would reflect exactly what you just said, which is, you know, about the ideology and how that, you know, helped them understand the world and so on and so forth. The issue with that, however, is that it didn't tell me much, if anything, about the person themselves. It didn't tell me anything about how they became involved, because, you know, my sort of observation was, well, I intellectually can understand the story you're telling me, but I suspect there's a lot of people out there who also were exposed to these ideas, but you were the one who became involved, not, you know, most everybody else. So I started to think about how to unpack that a little bit, and with the help of a colleague of mine, I started trying to ask better questions. So instead of asking, why did you become involved in a terrorist group, I started asking, how did you become involved? And that's when I started to appreciate the nuance and the diversity that's in these groups. So for some people, it is absolutely about getting exposed to ideas or ideology, and that resonates with something in them, and then they start to, you know, progress more and more into a movement. For others, it's the complete opposite. They get involved because of curiosity or a sense of adventure or excitement. They're looking to relieve boredom. There might be a friend who's involved, a family member. And it's only after that initial socialization do they then start to get access to the ideology. So if you like, for a lot of people, the ideology is a byproduct of involvement as opposed to, you know, setting it in motion, as it were.
Yeah, that lines up a little bit with your talk, Emily, about the idea that most of the people that you've worked with literally were recruited online playing a game. They built a relationship with them. The recruiter built the relationship with them.
Yeah, and they feel seen, they feel heard, they feel valued, that there's some alignment with their experiences of being rejected socially. In one case in particular, I'm thinking about this restoring a sense of honor for the family, that this young male feels that he wasn't quite able to attain because of numerous factors that has happened in his life, that he felt like he just continued to fail his family. But his family was shocked when they learned what he had attempted and said, no, this isn't honor. This is not an honorable act. This is shameful to us and our family, what you've attempted to do. So I think some of it could just be identity searching and confusion. And that leaves them very vulnerable to these recruiters online.
What's fascinating to me about what Dr. Horgan is saying, and I want to explore this a little more, is that potentially some of them didn't have to come from a position of already feeling either oppressed or feeling as if they were somehow or another slighted, that sometimes it can just be that whole idea of cognitive dissonance. You step into it one step at a time. You know, maybe I hate to pick, well, we'll talk more about what's going on college campuses, but I can see where a lot of the kids who ended up at those protests started by going to see a girl or a guy and staying, hanging out in the tent and singing songs and talking about peace. And before you know it, you know, they're one more step closer to being the guy that breaks out the window, moving into the college campus.
Yeah, fairly common story. So, and that's one of the things that we've seen over, you know, decades of study of mobilization to violent movements, which is that, you know, it's often a gradual process. It's a thousand little steps. I mean, for some people, of course, I mean, it can be more of the timeline can be a bit more compressed, but people don't just snap. They don't just, you know, become terrorists overnight. All of that stuff is, you know, it's popular stereotypes, but none of it is supported by the evidence. It is a gradual process of exploring different kinds of options. And very often it's about being at the right place at the right time, whether it's online or offline, and just, you know, finding opportunities and just going along with the process.
Have you spent much time, and I just want to talk about homegrown for a while, have you spent much time thinking about who the recruiters are of these people or the organizers are of these people, and what those structures need to look like, what those psychologies need to be?
It's as if you read my mind, Paul. I love that you asked that question, because the subject of my next book, on which I'm going to sign a contract today with Cambridge University Press, is on the recruiters. So the short answer is...
By the way, I'm a politician, so I shamelessly... you know, go out and advocate for whatever I'm doing all the time. You won't even be close to what I can get away with doing.
I'll happily talk about recruiters for the next hour. So yeah, that's okay. The thing. So for all of the time that I've been doing this research, I've been obsessed with the people that we call the recruits, you know, who they are, why they do what they do, how and why they get involved, what do they have in common, what do they have that distinguishes them from you and me, and you know, and again, what we can do about it.
I did notice in looking through the title of books that we read in the introduction that was the piece that I didn't see, at least in the titles. Now, I've only read two and a half of the books. Now, I'm going to read all of them, because I can tell you, I really think you are maybe the best expert we have in this country on this issue. But the point is that that seems to me to be the natural evolution of where you would have been taking this. Who are the recruiters?
Oh, thank you for saying that. It's probably taken me a little bit too long to come to that realization, but I have realized that, we have focused so much of our effort on understanding the radicalization part of it that we've tended to overlook the fact that there are also recruiters. There are people, you know, they are the shadowy figures in already shadowy processes who will push and pull and cajole and coax and groom and seduce, and they will find whatever it is that is in you, and they'll twist and turn, and if you're ideological, they'll pull on that. If you are someone looking to redeem yourself for some past failing or criminal conviction, past whatever it is, they'll pull on that. If you're someone who is just, you know, looking to escape a hopeless situation and live a life of adventure, they'll sell you with that. So we know next to nothing about the recruiters, and they are, you know, they're few and far between, but we know they exist. And right now, they're doing a hell of a good job online in terms of trying to, you know, radicalize and recruit and mobilize our children into action. And we urgently need to figure out who they are, why they do what they do. Are they following a playbook? Are they just naturally charming people, pseudo-psychologists that just know how to get people to do things for them? And we have no idea.
You know, it's interesting. The one of the terms that's thrown around a lot is this concept of the dark triad, the person who's Machiavellian and narcissistic, as well as having some level of psychopathy. And I'm not a psychologist, so I apologize if I...
You did well.
All right. So, but I have met recruiters. I've met a couple of different recruiters in different fields, some of which were more extreme, some of which were less. And they all had a charisma about them. They all had an ability to be extremely persuasive when you were talking to them. One of the things that I did that got me in a little bit of trouble when I was in Egypt, I actually went and met with an Al-Qaeda member who was an academician. I went to his place. We sat around and talked. He then sent me a couple of emails, and that got me put on the no-fly list. But nonetheless, it was amazing listening to him because his view of the world was so completely different than mine as an American, and he was extremely convincing. Now, it probably helped him that he'd spent time as a professor, but he was a recruiter. That was, when you really got down to it, that was what he was doing, trying to recruit people in groups. Now, he would do it by speeches. He would go out and give speeches to different groups of people. But how accurate in your early part of the study would you say that is, that there's a personality trait that seems to apply to them, this dark triad, or there are other names out there as well? What's your take on that?
I love how you sidestepped what is clearly a fascinating story that you need to tell us, but let's put that aside. The short answer is I don't know. And you know,
by the way, that's what the Justice Department said to me. So.
Yeah, you can't just say there I was, you know, talking to an Al-Qaeda recruiter who happened to be an academic. Nonetheless, you know, you can't do that. So, however, and I love, by the way, the implication that because he's an academic and he's charming, that academics must be charming. You clearly have not met a lot of academic professors, but yeah, let's move on. The short answer is I don't know. I've learned to be very, very careful about bringing my own assumptions into this field. And so, you know, I want to, I've met some terrorist recruiters, not a lot, but I, you know, based on that, I clearly want to learn more. I do feel that there's probably a lot to be learned by talking to and listening to recruiters from different contexts. So, for example, does recruitment in Al-Qaeda work in the same way as it does for recruiting people to join the U.S. military or the clandestine services in the CIA or gangs or the sex trade or whatever it might be? There are the recruiters in each of those contexts who, you know, and I assume they have to spend, you know, they have to run the gamut. Some are clearly very good at what they do. Some are not so good. Some might be very charming. Some might be I have no idea. The short answer is I don't know, but hopefully we'll find out.
Okay.
But I'm positive that, you know, and when I was putting together this proposal for the book, for the recruiter's book, I did a lot of research just to make sure, first of all, you know, maybe there's some researcher out there who's already done it, and it turns out that that's not the case. But clearly, an awful lot has been done and is known about recruitment in other contexts. So, you know, there are people who study recruitment in gangs and in for the military, for example, and that's very, 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 very well documented. So are terrorist recruiters the same? I mean, I have no idea.
All right, I'm fascinated by this because now what I want to know before we go back to talking about extremism and this topic, I want to know, how do you do this? You're going to go out and you're going to write this book. What's your process going to be to write this book and to study recruiters? How are you going to do that?
1 year of research, 1 year of writing. So the research, you know, there are several different ways in which we can try to get access to people who are involved in terrorism. And, you know, lots of different factors come into that, whether or not somebody is still involved in a terrorist group or whether or not someone is disengaged, you know, when someone is involved in a prison setting or not. It's very outside of clinical or intervention context. It's extremely difficult to get access to people in the prison system here in the United States. For the most part, if you are a researcher looking to learn about terrorist psychology, you have two choices. You can either speak to people who were formerly involved or you can go overseas and you know, and engage in research and go into conflict zones and speak to people. It's not hard. There's a lot of preparation and things that go into it. I don't consider myself an unnecessary risk taker. I mean, I'm very careful and deliberate and cautious about what I do. There are some things that I'll do in an interview or a fieldwork context. There are also lots of things that I won't do. Some of my colleagues have talked about allowing themselves to be, you know, blindfolded or bundled into the trunk of a car. I mean, I will not do that. I'll meet people in public places. It all depends on the context, but we can do this research safely, we can do it rigorously, and we can also do it ethically, which I think is very, very important as well. But there's a process, and it's not especially difficult. It can just be very, very, very time consuming. And sometimes it's about writing elaborate letters or emails saying, you know, listen, this is who I am. I'm an academic, and I would like to ask you questions about how and why and where and when you became involved and your experiences and things like that. Sometimes it involves making formal contact with an organization and asking to be put in touch with someone. And so, there are different results that come from different kinds of approaches, but it can be done. And research, you know, we can learn an awful lot from that kind of research.
All right. So to return to the idea of extremism, at the beginning of this show, when we were off the air, you expressed a pessimism. You said you're sometimes you become pessimistic about where we are in our ability to deal with this issue. Explain that to me, if you can. What is making you pessimistic today?
I don't know, maybe it's the Irish in me, but I think I'm deeply pessimistic about human nature generally. I'm also a psychologist. I think that's I love psychology. I think it is, you know, it's a big part of who I am and what I do. When it comes to terrorism and counterterrorism, I think I just have no faith in governments to tackle this problem in a way that doesn't inevitably make the problem 10 times worse. And some of that has to do with the fact that terrorism is an unenviably complicated problem. We often talk about terrorism as a form of psychological warfare. Humiliation and, you know, making us feel helpless, making us feel powerless, making us feel that you or I or our loved ones might simply be walking down the street and killed in the name of some cause that we've never even heard of, let alone understand. I mean, that's the power of terrorism. So much of it is wrapped up in fear and making us feel that helplessness. I think governments are very good at what is sort of euphemistically referred to as kinetic approaches to terrorism. So capturing, killing people, things like that. But when it comes to preventing terrorism, I'm not optimistic, and in fact I'm becoming more pessimistic about that by the day. And yeah, I want to tie into a point you made about how I sort of equally made fun of you about being an optimistic American. I love the idea. I mean, I became an American citizen several years ago because that optimism clearly strikes a chord in me. I believe in this country, and I believe in the ideals associated with the idea of America. But you talked about, you know, with the power of one-on-one interventions. I see that as being one of the only ways that we can realistically do proper prevention when it comes to terrorism. It's just so extraordinarily resource intensive that I just don't think it's realistic. And so when we try to scale up our approaches here, then you know, things tend to fall apart.
So I am optimistic, but being an optimist doesn't mean that you ignore the problem. And this is a real problem that exists. And in fact, it's one that can grow, because today I have a very deep concern about jihadism. I have been in politics long enough to know that terrorism goes way beyond jihadism. There are lots and lots of different groups who can become radicalized on the right, on the left. Political leaders play into that. The challenge that I think that we have, and the reason for at least the program that we've put together, is people are being bombarded with a negative message about who we are. The American brand is under an intense assault by all sides, right? The political parties, where 70% of the people who run for a political office win inside the primary, meaning they never even have to talk to someone in the other party, they're only addressing 6% of the public. I can do the math for you. It's 6% of the public that they're addressing. And half of that is going to be more extreme. In fact, if you go far enough, about 1/6 of that probably has psychopathy, right? I mean, it's you can look at the numbers and begin to recognize that those groups tend to be more extreme. So the parties intuitively need to terrify them. And that's the way that they galvanize their base, is that they terrorize them about the other side. Everything is existential. Yeah, so that's one message that we're getting. Sure. And then the politicians who want to win, they have to go appeal to them. So they give this existential message. And then the news media, which used to be less biased, has figured out the power of niches. And so now they're playing to that group and they're bombarding us with these negative messages, because if they terrify you, you'll watch tomorrow. You just want to see what's going to happen. If you tell me, if I can find out 4 or 5 data points about any human being, I can terrify them politically. I guarantee it, because we all come from a small basis. And then you add tribalism into that. You start adding the idea of cognitive dissonance into that. And then we all creep one step closer to it. Now, here's the problem with that. Look at what we've created. Through this concept of individualism, we have this concept of individualism in the United States that was our birth, right? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. That very simple idea became so powerful that we changed the world. And there's no doubt about it. Human progress has done more to advance because of that idea, not just in the United States, around the world. The more we empowered the individual, the better we did. But as people become terrified, they, instead of looking at other people as individuals, they start to look at them as part of a group. They look at them as part of Black Lives Matter or MAGA or whatever label you want to put on top of them. And then we begin to go to where you and Emily are talking about. We begin to objectify them, as opposed to recognizing the gifts that they have to give us, the benefits that they have to give us. And of course, when we do that, they do it right back to us. Anybody who's been in a debate about Donald Trump, I don't care what side you're on, you know that's what's happening, right? We're being further divided. And instead of the other side looking at me and saying, oh, well, what you have to say makes sense, I'm willing to listen to it, they see me as being part of some alien tribe that's out to destroy them, and I'm an existential threat. Yeah. And again, it almost doesn't matter what side. Well, what can we be optimistic about in that? We can be optimistic about who we are and what we've done and what we've accomplished. I don't know that we can change the media. I don't know that we can change the political parties or the politicians. But we, at least as citizens, can begin to put this in perspective. Right. You know, if I were to ask you, what percentage of the population do you think is a terrorist? I don't know. What would you tell me?
Oh, so tiny, it's infinitesimal. I mean, this is the thing. There's so much fear and scaremongering around terrorism, and this in no way minimizes the real consequences that this has on people's lives. But I mean, it is still a lightning event. I mean, it is very, very, very unlikely to happen. What you've just described, all of which I agree with, is the problem of polarization and, to an extent, radicalization. That isn't necessarily going to inflate the risk of terrorism, but what it does in the system is create an awful lot of noise where it can be very, very difficult to figure out what potentially constitutes a threat or not. But you're talking about a sliver of a percentage.
All right. So you've spent, and this is something we're deeply interested in, and again, very few people have focused on there's a stream of people going into this. Yeah. Is there actually a stream of people coming out? And if they are, what are the factors that make it successful?
Yeah, so this was one of the things I started to look at back in 2003 or 4-ish, and some of it was kind of, it came from my own disillusionment when I saw 90% of my colleagues were interested in the front end part of the process. I thought to myself, well, you know, I wonder, you know, is this the one way street that we think it is? And it turns out that it's not. People can and do leave terrorist organizations for all kinds of reasons, and they can also leave at different parts of the process. So some, you know, they dip a toe in the water and they decide, you know what, it's not for me. You know, this reality is very different than what I thought it was going to be, and I'm going to do something else. Now, it might be that they wind up doing something else in the same movement, but they decide, you know what, I just this particular role is definitely not for me. And so, people can and do leave. We call it disengagement. And again, you know, to go back to the field work and the research, I mean, they'll talk. I mean, people like to talk. They like to tell their stories. They view academics as, you know, as Douglas Adams would say, you know, mostly harmless. And so they'll grant interviews and they can tell us about their process. And so we've done lots of interviews with people who have left across the spectrum, from extreme left to extreme right, jihadist, you know, you name it. And there are lots of similarities. Disillusionment is the big one. Now, the disillusionment might happen for a dozen different kinds of reasons, but that is the main theme we find among people who want to.
Give me an example. Tell me what that means.
So disillusionment can be, I fantasized for years about what it would be like to join this group. And then now that I'm in, I'm having to scrub toilets, or I'm having to just do menial tasks while my brothers and my sisters are off doing, you know, meaningful frontline activity. Sometimes people get disillusioned with the ideology, the tactics, the strategy of the group. Sometimes terrorist groups go too far. They might do something whereby they deliberately set out to kill lots and lots of people, where even for some members of that group, that's a step too far. Or they might change tactics in such a way that they decide to deliberately go and kill children. And some members are just not comfortable with those tactical changes. Now, the flip side to that is also just as valid, because as we've seen in the Irish context for many, many years, sometimes people will leave groups because the tactics don't go far enough. So you have people who will say, well, no, we need to be hitting more targets. We need to be engaging in more bombings, and when that's not allowed for political or other strategic reasons, these people will often leave, and they'll try to set up splinter factions. That by and large tend to be even more extreme in what they do. And disillusionment. I'll just say one more thing about that. Disillusionment doesn't have to happen for big reasons to do with strategy or group goals or things like that. Very often it's because I'm in a cell with a guy, as in a terrorist cell, with some guy I don't know. He's pissing me off. And you know, I didn't get involved in this to be barked at or to receive orders from some guy who doesn't even acknowledge all that I've given up to be here. So, you know, petty squabbles, jealousy, they're just a regular, you know, interpersonal friction. Those are the kinds of things that often lead to people being really, really fed up. And then, you know, asking questions about, well, you know, maybe it's not too late. Maybe I can get out of this. I interrupted you, sir.
No. So I want to test another theory that Emily and I have worked on. And because it fits into this portion of it, which are people who are leaving. One of the concepts, Emily, that you might talk a little bit about is that in general, it becomes very, what you've experienced in, what is it that they called it, applied psychology, is that to get people to actually come out, you rarely get them to leave the worldview, but you might get them to focus on other aspects of their life. And that, in fact, if you try to get them to leave the worldview, oftentimes they become more violent. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so Bellinger is a great researcher on this process who has looked at the socio-cognitive process of indoctrination, radicalization to the point of violent extremism. One of the things that he mentions is, you know, don't confront the ideology head on. Don't, because it's not really logical to them. And so people think, well, if I'll just present them with facts and evidence as to why their beliefs are wrong, as an expert or even a concerned family member or other people in the community, that will actually push them farther away, because now they're going to be feel more threatened, feel more angry, feel more betrayed, and that will further solidify them in the ideology. So the recommendation is, this is really so much emotion-based, and you can't rationalize with these emotions. And so the best thing is really try and ground them and root them in the identity that they had prior to their radicalization and indoctrination. This might be, you know, through a family member. I have one very clear-cut example as I'm thinking about you talking about this process. There was one person who had lost his father, and he was grieving, and there was an imam in a Muslim community who really was seen and viewed as this father figure. And there was unfinished business, a feeling by this person that they had shamed or dishonored their father, and felt like they needed to restore this respect and value. And so that really got projected onto this relationship that this imam was able to really fulfill. But this person was all of those characteristics and traits of a recruiter, and saw that there was a lot of talent in this person that they were able to then pull out and use, have personal benefits, but also benefits for the local mosque. It took the wife to say, I'm going to leave you and take our children if you don't get out, that this has gone too far. And you need to make a choice. It's either us or them. And I think how powerful, how hard that was for her to do, but how powerful that was to pull him back towards his identity of, like, you are a husband and a father, and you're choosing to be part of this community and this sect and this radical ideology and worldview. It is so consuming of you. And I think in part it was successful in pulling and rooting him back into being a father and being a husband.
Dr. Horgan?
Yeah, and you know, I've seen that work both ways as well, because, you know, sometimes it will be a way of effectively pulling somebody out of these groups, as you said, Emily, and at other times it's a way of pulling people in. You know, it's a way of, you know, and ISIS were masters of this, where they would use people to
pull
other family members and pull them all in and give them a home to say, you know, as they've said in one of their propaganda videos, there's a role for everybody. You don't have to be involved in the fighting. You know, we need doctors, nurses, engineers, you know, we need people who can do social media, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, very, very, very powerful narrative.
You know, that is, that to me, this, how this becomes applied, I have a very large family. I mean, a very large family, and they hang out with one another. We like to say that we'd die for one another if we don't kill one another first, but we're very tight. And we've had a couple of people in our family drawn into very extreme ideologies. We call it addictive. Emily and I call it addictive because the idea of addiction is that you keep doing something that's harming you and you can't stop, right? These were ideologies that were so addictive that they, as they were pulled into it, it began to damage them. It began to cause them grief at their jobs. It caused them grief amongst family members. It caused them grief in their life. And after Emily's advice, what we worked on was quit talking about the subject. Quit talking about the political issue that was driving them in that direction, and instead talk about their kids and talk about their family and talk about their job and talk about other things that they were good at. There was no way to change their worldview. Zero. And in fact, I love them to this day. I haven't we've had zero effect on changing their worldview. Yeah. And if we focus on that, they start to become radical, and it starts to overpower the other parts of their life. They start to say, well, if this happens, then my kids are in danger, and then my house is in danger, and my job is in danger, and the country is going to fall apart, and it becomes existential. And then all of a sudden, the political view is more important than their kids, as opposed to if you can get them to focus on the things that matter, you start to see some movement. Your thoughts on that?
There's been a long-standing tension there in countries all over the world that are trying to facilitate, you know, disengagement. And there's a related word that sneaks into these discussions, and it's called de-radicalization. And the discussion, you know, for good or for bad, has sort of followed this fairly simplified view of, well, do we need to get people to disengage or first, or do we need to de-radicalize them? And, you know, again, trying to be, let's not say optimistic for a second, but trying to be realistic in what we can do here. I mean, I've always felt that the priority ought to be, let's just get the person to disengage from what they're doing. And that then, you know, to paraphrase, you know, what you both just said, that then creates the space and the safety and the distance for other ideas to creep in. But certainly, you know, and governments have made tremendous policy errors in this since 9/11 and beyond, addressing ideologies head on, trying to fight one ideology with another. And it just creates a reaction in people where they just get their backs up, and then the defensiveness starts and the walls go up, and then, you know, you've lost before you've even begun. So yeah, seeing shared humanity, you know, getting people to the point where the cracks can begin to appear in the armor. You can do all of those kinds of things without challenging somebody about their worldviews.
Yeah, it's to me, that's kind of the fascinating area. Politics used to be, you know, I was mayor, I don't know, a long time ago, 25 years ago. And at that time, one of the amazing things was, like, if I got into a cab, I usually knew a lot more about politics than the cab driver. Today, I go to cities and the cab drivers blow me away about how much they know. That's partly happened because politics has increasingly become more marketable, right? It's marketable on TikTok. It's marketable on X, it's marketable on Facebook, it's marketable in the news, and people have figured out a way to make money from it. So politics is the place where we go to solve our problems. And by the way, there are real problems that have real challenges and that are not easy to fix. They just exist in every society on the planet. We've decided to resolve them without a king, without a monarch, without a dictator, and to do it in a way in which people have a chance to participate by electing their elected officials. But it's still messy. It's still difficult. If you focus on that process every minute, it becomes really divisive inside of our communities. And to me, part of what needs to happen in the United States is, you know, I think about, like, when I was a little kid and we watched the Apollo mission going to the moon, the entire country was focused on it. And that was during the time of Watergate, right? We were watching Watergate, but we were also watching the second landing on the moon. Today, we have every bit as unbelievable things happening. We have three men in a race to privately get to Mars, right? I mean, it's amazing to see what these three are doing, but we're not covering it. It's not getting any exposure because it's not as sexy as the divisions that we have, the divisions that exist. And to me, the constant focus on politics is one of the changing things that's having an effect on the psychology of Americans. Your thoughts?
The end.
Okay. All right. So
I'm not sure what to say to that. I mean, it's I mean, yes. So I want to be devil's advocate now here for a second then. So, I mean, do you see where I'm coming from when I'm talking about me feeling pessimistic, that how on earth are we going to be expected to come together to fight a social problem like terrorism when this is the kind of environment in which we find ourselves right now? And maybe that's too simplistic. I mean, I try to not allow myself to feel helpless when it comes to advocating for solutions. I have seen firsthand where there are solutions that we can build and implement for doing better about prevention at a local level, for example. I know from the evidence and spending 2 decades of studying terrorist psychology, I know where the nuggets are, the nuggets of gold where we can, really, really, really drill down into and figure out, okay, there's something here and we can run with it. But I think we're producing more terrorists than we're preventing. And that is the fundamental problem with that kind of divisiveness and rancor that just doesn't allow us to come together. And this, as a former politician, you might say I'm naive in thinking this, but the only time we ever really have serious conversations about terrorism is when there's bombs going off in American cities. So we're not, and God forbid if and when that happens again, that's not the time to have conversations about what to do to prevent terrorism.
Well, I'll give you a couple of things. The first one, as I said a moment ago, just being optimistic doesn't mean that you ignore the problems. At the same time, I would tell you that the reason to be optimistic is because the people who are going to solve the problems are the people who believe that we can. There's a very low likelihood of solving the problems with people who believe we can't, right? So then I'm going to get to the third thing, how our system works. So I'm going to give you an example. I was a Democrat. I'm an independent today. I was a Democrat for things like civil rights, equal rights, human rights. Those mattered a lot to me, as did property rights, as did the free market. I left because, to me, some of those fundamental issues I thought were under assault. And two, I didn't think I could solve the problem in being a Democrat. I thought that I needed to try to move to a more neutral position. Mm-hmm. I have gotten to a point where I can see the excesses in both parties. And that doesn't mean that on any given issue I might see more excess on one side or the other, but it's obvious to me both sides have excesses. So I'm going to pick out an issue, wokeism, right? Which, by the way, you could have 1,000 definitions for what woke means, right? But let's just kind of go to the idea of that we identify people as being a part of a group, right? So white privilege, right? To me, white privilege, talking about white privilege, same thing as talking about a white genocide. You've decided there are problems in the world and you can fix them by identifying people based upon the group that they're a part of. I believe we should judge people by the content of their character. I'm an old, maybe liberal, who believes in human rights, civil rights, and equal rights, and that everybody should be seen equally in the process. Now, in saying that, I'm watching a lot of people on podcasts who are terrified about wokeism. And here's what I would tell them. You already won. The conversation, I don't know who did these college campus protests, but whoever came up with the idea of, hey, you know what? Here's how we're going to convince the American public. We're going to go put up some tents. We're going to live like slobs for a little while. We're then going to take a hammer and break through windows. And we're going to wear masks so people won't know who our identity is. Who did you convince? You didn't convince anybody. You lost ground. Whatever cause you had, you moved in the wrong direction. The way you win is through conversation. Free speech works. And the more we talk about things, the better things become, because the better idea keeps winning. Now, that's not the same thing as fighting and labeling and degrading other people because of their beliefs, but having an honest conversation. Podcasts, I think, are an incredible way to begin solving the problem, because you have a lot more people speaking. And there are some crazy bad ideas on podcasts. It's okay, because there are other better ideas. In terms of your field, to me, your field, it's not just about when Al-Qaeda breaks through and hits our Twin Towers. It's happening on our college campuses. It's happening within MEGA. It's happening within the woke community. It's about a mindset of people who begin to move slowly towards more extreme positions. And eventually, those extreme positions, if not resolved, become violent. How do you fix it? Doing just what you're doing, writing books, talking about it, speaking about it. I've been reading your books. I was inspired. I believe, hey, there are solutions to this problem. but we're going to have to become more committed to them if we want to actually make a difference.
My books aren't going to solve anything, and that's not false modesty, but I mean, I think one of the casualties in the kinds of conditions you've described is that we fail to see nuance in anything anymore. So you know, I think it's hard to have a conversation and hard to have a podcast when there are people who simply don't want to listen. So I could be writing books for the rest of my days. I'd be very happy because that's what I like to do, and it makes me happy when I put out a book. But at a certain point, I sort of feel like, well, I may end up writing these kinds of books because they're the kinds of books that I want to read. But I'm not sure that people even want to listen anymore, let alone read books. I mean, it is a tall order to ask someone to read a book on terrorism, let alone read the kinds of, you know, esoteric, more narrowly framed books that I do.
Well, I'm more hopeful in your books maybe than you are for this reason. You just told me you spend 2 years writing one of those books, and for $14, I get the summary of that entire thing in a way in which that is much richer than we can get in a 1 hour podcast. And your books, I can tell you, they made a difference in terms of what I read. Because you can't fix a problem until you can identify it. You have to identify what it is and what's happening. And you've spent a lot of time doing that. Now, if you don't mind, I'm going to make a turn because I'd like to know kind of your thought on this. So we've talked a lot about homegrown terrorism. I'd like to talk about state-sponsored terrorism for a moment and how that maybe differs. I'm gonna pick on the West Bank, although God only knows there are a lot of places around the world that have state-sponsored terrorism going on. I'm going to focus on Gaza in particular. But what I'm really interested in isn't as much Gaza as I am this concept of when you take the recruitment element, and instead of it being done online, all of a sudden you give these coercive powers of the press, the media, the religion. You'd give the coercive powers of the religion itself, as well as educational system, the schools, kindergarten, and government, the ability to tax and take money away from you, to extract things from you or put you in jail. It seems to me that that power becomes a much more lethal force. I'd just love to have your thoughts on that.
You know, there's been 50 plus years of social science research on terrorism. I haven't been around for all of that time, obviously, but putting all of that together across different ideologies, we've got a couple of prominent themes that emerge about how and why people become terrorists. One of the main common denominators across the spectrum of ideologies is the role the urgent need to respond to some grave injustice that has been done. That injustice is imagined. More often than not, it's real. But the thing that separates the mere radical from the terrorist is the person who looks at injustices and decides, I need to do something about this because talking about it isn't producing any results. Now, I'm not equating the majority of campus protesters with terrorists, obviously, but that sense of frustration and helplessness that can, in the right conditions, spiral into something far, far worse, that's where it has its roots. I was speaking at a conference in Sydney, Australia, just a couple of weeks ago, and talking about how, you know, the sort of the catastrophic overreaction by the Israeli Defense Forces, the Netanyahu government to Palestinians is going to, I mean, it's already counterproductive in terms of everything, but it is going to lead to a new generation of terrorism, terrorists worldwide. And a person came up to me afterwards and said, you know, but oh, but don't you acknowledge that the attack on Israel on October 7th was also horrific? And I was stunned to hear that question. I said, of course it was. It was, you know, the most appalling terrorist attack that country has faced so far. And that epitomizes to me, you know, again, this polarization where we can't even make a single point about a counterproductive response without being automatically assumed to have a preconceived set of views here. So I think all of this certainly ties into the symptoms of polarization that we're in right now, where we can't even agree on what's happening, and that is this is at the heart of why I don't think we are well equipped to respond to terrorism.
Well, the one thing that I think people are definitely focused on is not how do you win a war, but how do you win the peace. I mean, we've seen many examples throughout American history where we've won the war and lost the peace. We found examples in American history where we lost the war, such as Vietnam, but actually kind of over time won the peace. There are if the idea is to reach a long-term settlement that ensures of more peace, I think that there is a conversation that's important. And the idea that when we take actions, we should be concerned about what will the final outcome be should be a definite part of the conversation, if you ask me. Emily?
Oh, there's so much to unpack there. I think just going back to what you were saying about the college campuses and the hope, and Dr. Horgan did touch upon this, that if there is this feeling of helplessness and victimization and a sense of injustice, and that is seducing you to join this cause, in my personal belief, I think that the momentum for this mass movement that we're seeing on college campuses pre-existed October 7th, and I worry how academia, even in psychology itself, is potentially supporting this narrative of grouping different people and classifying them into this oppressed versus oppressor category.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that is promoting this sense of injustice, this personal injustice. So then I think when October 7th happened, it was timely because this movement was already growing and they were able to utilize that to then start to protest. But it went beyond just free speech, as Paul was saying. It was antagonizing, harassing Jewish students. The challenge was that you have academics and even professors who were coming out in support of the cause, but that there was this anti-Semitism. Even in our school here at ASU, I had one professor just a few days ago said, people are coming in wearing Nazi gear. Yeah. We can't stop them because that is a violation of their free speech. And until they physically do something or they threaten to the extent that it would be considered a hate crime, we cannot prevent it. And then I worry, well, what are the policies on campuses? Like, at what point is this going beyond? They're not providing enough boundaries that are very clear that are being violated. And I think if this was any other cause, or any other issue or against any other group, would they be responding differently? But again, it goes back to what is being taught in universities and what is the philosophical paradigm that is maybe contributing to this growing number of distress, unrest, this perceived, and I'm not saying social injustices haven't occurred, but how are we teaching them to still maintain agency, attack the issue in a more pro-social way where we can have some shared beliefs working towards peace and resolution and critical thinking rather than suppressing narratives or threatening to fire teachers or canceling teachers where there's this real fear, climate of fear happening as well. So, you know, I think it comes back to, you know, that oppressed versus oppressor mentality. And is that something that's being taught? And how can we change that even within academia?
But I think it could be used as a way to create improvement, right? I mean, one way to deal with it is it's existential. And I don't know, I don't like it, but I just don't feel like it's existential. I look at these college campuses and I go, they're kids, right? They're kids.
Their frontal lobe's still developing.
And they're figuring out life and they're trying to, you know, yeah, they don't have maybe as much history as they should. They're kids, right? And so I tend to see it as a learning opportunity as opposed to a look at how bad these kids are. The idea that we could utilize it as a way to have a greater discussion. You know, I mean, if you go to Israel, this whole idea that we want to plug in this decolonization movement, right? It doesn't work. It's not the decolonization. The idea of colonization is, hey, there are this group of people who are outsiders that came in and oppressed these indigenous people. Well, the reality is Jews and Arabs are both indigenous to the Middle East. Right? They're neither one of them completely fit into it. I mean, I guess you could argue the Ottomans were occupiers and colonialists as well, and Palestine got to where they were because of it. The issues are complex, and there's lots of strands that are in it. And when you begin to understand it better, and you understand the complexity, then you understand that the solutions aren't as easy as doing a protest and causing a change to happen. But that protest can either be a means for us to feel like it's an existential threat and figure out how to shut it down, or it can be a means where we can try to engage a better conversation amongst our historians and amongst people who do know what's going on in the Middle East and amongst Jewish people and amongst Palestinians to try to see if even here there's an ability to find common ground.
Paul, don't be insulted when I say this. You sound like an academic, and I mean that in the kindest possible way. But you're assuming that people, if I may, I think you're assuming that people are able to logically and rationally and calmly and coolly think through these issues with insight and perspective and history and respect. That is not happening. That's not consistent with emotion on the ground. And again, you know, there's 50 shades, right? So we're talking about protesters, we're talking about young people. You say kids. I don't like calling my kids kids because I'm a college professor, and I, you know, if I think of them as kids, and I can't hold them accountable to, you know, getting assignments
in on
time and things like that. However, you're talking about a community or series of communities that runs the gamut from young people who are tremendously shocked and upset about seeing things happening in the world, seeing injustice around which they feel they have no voice and around which they feel like their political leadership doesn't care, right through to your external agitators, to your full-on Hamas supporters and sympathizers. And of course, we are defining this community like we always do by their roughest edges. And so, you know, there is far more going on. But Emily, to your point, I mean, yes, I mean, we saw anti-Semitism in the United States had been reaching stratospheric levels long before October 7th. And I think when October 7th hit, it just became a catalyst for anti-Semitic far-right groups around the world, let alone here. So, you know, I don't want to use the silly phrase, you know, when the dust settles. I think the dust is going to be kicking around for a very, very long time. There's lots and lots and lots of conversations that are going to have to happen, not least at places like where I work in university, because we've got fundamental issues around freedom of speech. You know, and where the rules are around, well, you know, there's a big difference between freedom of speech and making students feel unsafe on their very own campuses. And if people don't understand that, then we have a longer way to go than having conversations about how to, you know, constructively engage in society and deal with conflict resolution, you know, halfway around the world.
So That was a big insult that you called me an academia.
Well, sorry if the shoe fits.
I could have called you a politician,
which would have been accurate, and yes.
That's true. So first, I think there are problems in our college campuses. One of the problems that I see that exists is the lack of civics and the lack of understanding of how power really works and what really has happened historically. And there seems to be a group of people who are inside of our universities that are actually promoting the idea of postmodernism and colonialization or post-colonialization and critical race theory. And I don't mind those things being there. I'm not sure that we have enough of a balance on the other side within them. But the point that I would make, not as a as an academician, but as a politician, was, again, I came from the left, but it's not lost on me. If, you know, I mean, let's think about people who are in the MAGA movement. If you look back at the things that I supported, civil rights, equal rights, the Me Too movement, right? In any of those cases, there were victims, and sometimes there were innocent victims, people who lost a job or didn't get a promotion, or maybe they said an off-color joke and they ended up being set back. Whatever the issue is, there were people who lost in that. And then we silenced them, because if they spoke up, they were a racist. If they spoke up, they were a bigot. Well, it was inevitable somebody was going to come along and say, hey, I see you. I see who you are. And I'm going to speak for you. And when you do that, then those people will follow them wherever they go. It doesn't matter what lie they tell, what crime they commit. It just doesn't matter, right? Because they were seen. What I'm worried about with these kids is that we do the same thing to them, right? I am definitely against anti-Semitism. I'm definitely on the side of Israel in this conflict. I'm far and away on that side because of the time that I spent there and because I think their values are much closer to ours than the people of Gaza. That doesn't mean that I justify in any way some mom having to pull her 2-year-old baby out of a pile of rubble. Of course it's horrific, and we should feel bad. Every time we see that, even whether it's our effort or theirs, we should feel bad. But we also have to remember in this process that these students that are Americans, as you said, there are fringes of them, the ones who are not part of the recruitment group, that discussion and allowing them to be heard is an important part of the process, the important part of talking. Now, they have to listen to the other side as well. And I do think if we utilize this as a means to make certain that we're including people and listening to people and it's sharpening our skills on being able to listen and talk back and forth, that over a longer period of time, we can make improvement on this. I tend to not like, I am a free speech advocate through and through, and I believe that shutting people up oftentimes creates damages in ways in which you're not even thinking about it.
Fair point. Counterpoint, however, I would say that needs to go both ways, because at the same time, and I don't teach critical theory, I don't have any colleagues who teach critical theory, whoever, at the same time, faculty in universities shouldn't be policed for exposing young people to a wide variety of different perspectives then. I mean, and I think that's, it's a slippery slope.
Well, I tend to believe I actually agree with you, but you know, then I would go to the DEI groups and say, hey, you shouldn't be forcing professors to take pledges on things that they don't agree with or they'll lose their job otherwise. The answer is, I might be more on the side of diversity, but it doesn't harm us to have conservative professors that we're listening to as well. And to me, the complaint with to me, I agree with you on the idea of, I don't want to shut up the people who believe in critical race theory. I think that we should have a discussion about it. But we shouldn't demonize the people who are on the opposite side of them. In fact, we should embrace them. We should make certain that people understand the complexity of the issue. And again, I come down to this. Man, our system, we're not just the greatest superpower in the history of mankind. We've done more to promote human progress than anybody anywhere in the world because of the values that we have. I don't care if you're on the right or the left. Yeah. Don't abandon them quickly, because those values have done a lot.
I hear what you're saying. I really do. I teach at a public university in Georgia, our largest university, Georgia State. And I have a wide variety of different perspectives in my class. So my students, they are liberals, they're conservatives, and these are the kids that are the thought leaders. You know, this is not some liberal professor that's filling their heads with with ideologies. Mm-hmm. My goal is to get them to read the syllabus, do the assignments, engage in a conversation, but the conservative voices are there. They're just not always, you know, where you might think. I mean, but they are in our classrooms and they are coming from our students, and that is a good thing.
Anyway, well,
we were talking about terrorism 25 minutes ago. I'm not sure how we got to this.
Oh, to me they're interconnected, and they're interconnected in that when we think about people who begin to buy into extreme ideas, it's easy to see the jihadist. It's easy to see the incel member. Those are the ones Emily deals with and in many of your books that you're dealing with. Man, I'm worried about the extremists who aren't members of those groups, but that begin to take off on these factions on the right and the left, and all of a sudden you're either a libtard or a Trumptard. Right.
I mean, in my view, they are no more difficult nor easy to understand than, you know. So I think part of the challenge here is that some ideologies, just for all kinds of reasons, seem more foreign and distant and complex to us than they do to the believers. But the stories are the same. And this is my job as a psychologist, not just as a researcher, but as a psychologist, is to sort of try to peer beyond the content of the ideology and to try to figure out how ideology is what it means to that person. And once you start to do that, then, you know, your average jihadist, if there is such a thing, is not psychologically, socially speaking, that much different to your average member of a far right extremist group. They both are responding to what they feel is injustice around them. They both feel that the time for just talking about a solution is over, that they need to respond before their enemy is able to change their way of life forever. And they both come to the view, either on their own or with help, that violence is the only appropriate response here, because that will in turn mobilize others into action. I see no fundamental difference between them. And this is why I still, you know, it's a difficult category. It's a dirty word, terrorism, but that is the umbrella concept that unites all of these ideologically diverse movements. And my view has always been, I don't care what you think. I mean, I do care what you think, but you are entitled to think whatever you want. But if you choose to kill civilians in the name of your ideology, then you merit this label, and you merit the response that's going to come against you as a result.
And it seems to me, at what I've heard from both of you, which is why this applies from the jihadist to a far right organization or a far left organization, mm-hmm. is you don't have to be a sociopath to do that. You don't have to have a mental disorder to do that. You can actually be an average person who's drawn into it. Is that agreed by both of you?
Yes.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah. And it's not to say that there aren't psychopaths or sociopaths in some of these groups. I mean, there are people who want to join ISIS because they literally are excited about the prospect of cutting somebody's head off. But by and large, people are getting in there for, you know, a mixture of private and, you know, personal and political public reasons. But by and large, it's a fairly rational, thought out process where people are weighing up pros and cons of getting involved. And most terrorist groups that are any way reasonably effective tend to actually screen people out if they appear to be psychopathic or suffering from some obvious mental disorder or disability. They'll find reasons to get rid of them, because if they can't be depended on to do a job, then there is no place for them in these groups.
All right, and so last question for the average person, because that's kind of what we've brought this down to, that average people can be drawn into these, into extremism. What do you do as an individual to put a guard against that?
Well, I would take issue against the premise of your statement there. So for the longest time, for the first three or four books that I wrote on this topic, I made that same argument. You look, anyone in the right circumstances, you know, any of the three of us could be drawn in and we might find ourselves, you know, just going along with these groups. Over the years, I've tended to revise that statement. I think any of us might be attracted to the idea of it. But once we start to do more research, once we start to, you know, and if we have access to a group locally, we might show up at a protest, we might show up at a private meeting, we might learn more about what's really going on. That's when a lot of people decide, you know what, I thought it was for me, but I'm wrong. I definitely just want to keep going to the protests or whatever it is, or I'll send $50 to a charity overseas, but they're not going to get involved in violent extremism. That is the conundrum that really sort of shapes our inquiry here. We still don't have clear answers about what is it that makes that teeny tiny few cross the line to direct action.
That's terrific. Mm-hmm. Dr. Basha, I appreciate both of you being here today. And this is a conversation that will continue. Your book that's coming up, when's it coming out and where can people buy it? And what will the name of it be if you've gotten that far yet?
So I don't have a copy. So Terrorist Minds is my new book that came out in December that's just gone by. My new book, which I haven't written yet, that's The Recruiters. And that comes out in 2026.
The Recruiters.
Yeah,
oh, that's going to be fun.
It's The Recruiters, : how terrorist groups find the right stuff for the wrong reasons. But the sum total of everything I've learned about the psychology of terrorism is in Terrorist Minds. And that is the last book I'm going to write about terrorist psychology. So,
but when you get that book written, we're going to bring you back on if you don't mind.
I'd love to.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me. I greatly appreciate it. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Horgan. We appreciate your work.
Thank you.